The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Connect with ultra-fast speeds and our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home.
It's 9:24. I didn't mean to make the mascara run there with Dolly. I just thought it was a beautiful song. Let me welcome our guest this morning, Dawn French. What a pleasure it is to say good morning to you.
Oh, good morning to you and everybody that's listening. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Are you a Dolly fan?
Oh, huge. And in fact, Jennifer and I have been to see Dolly many times in concert and given each other the tickets as a bit of a treat. And let me tell you something, Ryan. Jennifer knows Dolly quite well and had dinner with her in LA when she was being all posh and doing some TV show over there, some little show called Friends, I think it was. And then she went out with Dolly and Dolly at the table was leaving half of the food on the side of her plate.
Yes.
And Jennifer said, oh, what's it? Do you not eat all your food? And she said, no, this half, well, you know, in a Dolly accent, which I can't do. This half is for me and this half is for the angels. And Jennifer said, oh, okay, good diet technique. And then you'll have to get this right with Jennifer, but this is how I remember it from Jennifer telling me. Dolly showed Jennifer a tattoo she has on the front that goes up amongst her bosoms.
Now, that is a revelation to me.
Oh, yes. Maybe you can ask Dolly about
this changes everything.
I know. I mean, maybe it was just a dream Jennifer had. It could be that.
It sounds kind of trippy.
I'm joining her in that dream. I'm joining her.
It's good to talk. You're a busy woman. My goodness, you have so much going on. I love that. You live quite near... You're kind of Daphne du Maurier country, are you, Dawn?
I definitely am, yeah.
And that would make great sense for you as a writer.
Definitely. Well, it's where I'm from. It's where my family are from. And I returned there about 16 years ago. And without a doubt, one of my intentions was to be able to write more rather than be in front of the camera. Wanted to be sitting quietly there on the very bay, actually, where du Maurier lived, funnily enough.
Really? And does it, it might be an odd question, but does it lend itself to a writer's life in terms of the good air, the almost, I don't know if it's as creepy as du Maurier's books were, but is it beautiful and inspirational?
It definitely is. Do you know what I think it is? It's a simple thing, and this will apply to anywhere particularly beautiful and remote.
Yeah.
Is that it's just a big sky and fresh air and birds flying above you and peace and hearing the sea. All of that just calms your mind. And when your mind is calm like that, that's when you can let in all the people, you know, that you're going to write about.
So according to the record, you're up of a morning at 7, you walk the dogs. Have you done that today already?
Have not, because I'm sitting in London. Not in London.
I for some reason I had you in Cornwall. Okay, you're on the circuit at the moment. And how many dogs do you have?
I have one dog, one cat.
Okay, names?
That's all I deserve, by the way. name of dog, Goody. Name of cat, Mauser.
And breeds of same?
Oh, I'm glad you're so interested. This is great. The dog is a Parsons Jack Russell Terrier.
A Parsons Jack Russell Terrier?
A Parsons Jack Russell, which is like a Jack Russell with long legs.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were named after some parson that bred them, you know, in the 1800s.
Good Lord.
But they're very elegant little, cheeky little dogs. And in fact, I wanted a very scruffy one. And we went to the breeder who... Yeah. Found me the scruffy bitch, the scruffy dog, and said, definitely, if we put these two together, you'll get a scruffy dog. And of course, I don't. I have a smooth-haired one. I have the mistake.
Did you know, I want to bounce towards your new book because of you, because in the 1950s, in Ireland, there were about three famous baby abduction cases in Dublin.
And
the babies were taken out from outside what would be the kind of equivalent of our Harrods or what have you, just snatched, and they ended up in Belfast. And the reason I say this is because your book is, while it's not outside a shop, obviously it's in a maternity hospital, the idea of having a baby snatched at birth is at once terrifying but equally captivating. And this is where you've come to for your book, and I'm curious to know why.
Well, you know, I wanted to write a book this time that had at the center of it a crime that would seemingly be unforgivable. Mm. With, you know, the character, the woman who snatches that baby at the beginning of my book, how could you ever forgive her? Surely you couldn't. But it's my job as the writer to challenge myself to see if we can understand this woman, wrap our understanding around her, and wrap our forgiveness around her. So I have, at the very beginning of this book, two very different women in the same maternity ward on the same night giving birth, and they both give birth to a baby daughter.
Yes.
And the very next morning, one of them leaves the hospital with a daughter and one doesn't. And the one who leaves has stolen the other woman's baby. So that's where we start. But of course, that's just the beginning. Really, what I want to do is see this child grow up. And that was a real treat to write the entire lifetime of a young woman growing from 0 to 18 and bonding with her mother, or who she thinks is, yes, her mother, who is her mother, as it happens. And then finding out, you know, what happens when you discover that your life is nothing like you thought it was, when somebody takes the rug from underneath you. And really, I guess I want to explore themes of identity and belonging and family and what we're made of, whether we're made of, you know, our DNA, or whether we're made of who's there for us and who steps up for us. That's what interested me. And I wanted to write this unforgivable crime at the centre of it and see if we could forgive that woman.
Yeah, very much so. And like everything in life, it is not simply the Nazis versus the Allies. It's not cut and dry. It's complicated. It's nuanced.
Yes,
she took the baby, but the part of you suddenly finds yourself going, but she took it because, you know, even though
that's
it was
right.
So utterly wrong.
She took it because.
Right.
And I also wanted to have a sort of moral dilemma,
right,
which is, did that baby actually, by dint of being stolen by that woman, did that baby end up in the right family after all?
That's right. I mean,
are we to say?
This is the sort of maternal sliding doors, if you like. I mean, who knows? And that, this is the conundrum, I suppose, to an extent, for people who are adopted. I say this respectfully to birth parents and adoptive families and the children involved, when they hit a certain age and go, I just need to know. And they can say, well, it's for medical records, and that's fine, because a large amount of time it is, and that features in your book. But a lot of the time it's just innate curiosity.
Absolutely. I mean, and we would imagine, wouldn't we, that everybody who wonders about their identity and their ancestry and their heritage and their tribe or whatever you want to call it, we imagine that everybody who's adopted would want that. And it's not the case, Ryan. It's not the case that everybody searches for that. Some people are content in their life and the understanding of what's come before. But, you know, I've adopted a daughter and who at the moment has, you know, she's nearly 30. At the moment, this is not of interest to her. However, the doors are open for that in the future. And my own mum was a remarkable woman who was involved with adoption, because she was on the panel. She worked with Children's Services a lot. And so my mum told me many, many stories of adopted and fostered kids and all the wonderful stories that you hardly ever hear of. And occasionally the more difficult stories where people go searching or maybe find things they don't want to find do find, you know, and connect up and connect the dots of their own lives, if you like. The anatomy of a family is an extraordinary thing to explore, isn't it?
Oh, we're all complicated novels, as we say. But, you know, in your case, did you ever think, okay, when my daughter comes the time, if in the event that she wants to find her birth mother, do you think that will be difficult for you, Dawn, or do you think you're well prepped for it now, 30 years on?
Do you know, I prepped for it 30 years ago, and
did
I've
you?
Been processing that ever since. Yeah, because that's the deal with an adopted kid. That's the contract, the moral contract you make, which is, I will support you in everything you need to do, because these are exceptional circumstances. But there are many people to protect. There's my daughter to protect, and there's also that birth mother who I don't know, but I love very much, and I have a lot to be thankful for. And I need to protect her choices also. So, you know, it's a complicated old thing that you that changes, you know, it's a sort of febrile thing that just it's elastic and it moves all the time. But I'm just, my promise as the adopted mum is to support any decision made by my daughter. That's my promise, and I'll do it whatever happens.
I'd say your heart breaks. Sometimes we talk to people on the show about adopting and being adopted, what have you, and I often think that probably the most difficulty is when they do meet, the adopted child eventually meets the birth mother or father, and when it's the opposite of magnetic. Chemistry
isn't
there.
Well, you know, those kids risk a second rejection, which is, you know, a mighty old catastrophe for them to live with. But also there are many wonderful stories, and don't forget about all the love that's involved actually adopting.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, in many instances, these kids have come into the lives of people who really want them very much. So it can be a really viscerally marvelous experience, because, you know, you're longing for a child, and that really is at the center of this book as well. The mother love
is a
strong line that goes, it's a deep dive into that.
It sure is, and this, it's a fairly modern expression, don't know if I love it, but it makes huge sense, is the blended family. You have two what are called stepchildren, but essentially they're your children, as you call them, and in real life, as I say, and so That is the modern way in so many respects, and it's the healthy way, and it's the kind way, and it's the loving way.
It is. Well, all you have to do is be kind, as you say. You know, you have to navigate your way through this complicated, you know, it's a bit of a minefield, can be, definitely. I mean, they are my stepchildren, but I am absolutely respectful and mindful of their mum. And, you know, I was not in their early life. She made them. You know, I completely understand that. But as long as you give your kids the freedom to make all kinds of choices and you don't get in the way of it, you don't blame them or add any kind of guilt or anything to any choices that they make, then you just stand back and go, okay, just decide. I mean, here we are coming up to Christmas. And every Christmas, what we say is, look, where is it best for you to be? You decide. You guys decide. They're adults. You know, they can decide. And we all kind of look after each other in a bigger way. You know, that's the way to try. Just try and be as kind as you can. I'm not saying it's, you know, problem free. Of course it's not. But, you know, so long as everybody knows that the intention is kindness, that's okay with me.
I agree with you. Let me ask you a few other things, because you're so busy with I'm just intrigued about this story about Roald Dahl meeting. I'm a big Dahl fan, so forgive me for dwelling on meeting Beatrix Potter. What in the name of goodness is this?
Did you know that that had happened?
No, I didn't
neither
know
did
that.
I
thought they were
neither
from different eras.
Yeah, I mean, how amazing. He was 6 years old. And if you know about Roald, you'll know that, you know, his dad had died, his sister had died. He'd had a really horrible, difficult life, even up to the age of six. And his mum knew that he was a big Beatrix Potter fan. That was his favourite. That was his favourite literature at that young age. And so she took him to Beatrix Potter's house, and I think she was only intending that he would be able to see it, but of course he wanted to find Peter Rabbit, so he went into her garden and he did meet her. And this was only a matter of minutes, and probably with the seemingly, from all the research, quite grumpy Beatrix, who was fed up of children coming up into her garden, probably this wasn't the most loving of encounters, let's put it that way. But he did meet her. And she did meet him. I mean, she did not know she's meeting the future Roald Dahl, but he certainly met his heroine. And of course, in a drama like this, written by this wonderful girl called Abby Wilson, you know, she's managed to make this little moment where they met a proper seismic moment in both of their lives that kind of changed the end. And if you look at Roald's writing, you can see the influence of Beatrix, actually.
So. Yeah.
And lots of people believe that Beatrix was, you know, cuddly because of the way that the animals looked that she drew. But anything but. In Beatrix's literature, you know, rats get their tails cut off, you know, rats eat kittens. I mean, Mr. McGregor was going to put Peter Rabbit in a pie. There's no doubt about it. You know, and the sort of horror, is there to be seen, as it is in Roald Dahl's writing.
As it is. The dark side but that's, you know, reflects real life too. It's not all bed of roses as well, you know.
So. No, definitely not. And kids are the best at dealing absolutely. With that kind of horror.
Yeah.
And that's what Roald Dahl knew, and that's what Beatrix Potter knew, is that they can deal with it. And there was nothing more horrific, was there, than Roald's actual real life at that age. His real life was full of darkness and difficult stuff. So, you know, he loved Beatrix's writing, and good on him. It's a beautiful film. It's got animation in it. It's very Christmassy and all
sounds
of that.
Sounds gorgeous. That's Christmas Eve, I think it's
full of heart. And, you know, one of the clever things that they've done is make sure that many of the characters in there reference either Roald's writing or Beatrix's writing. So Bill Bailey plays a gentleman that the young Roald meets on a train station. And if you look a bit closer, you're seeing the BFG, you know.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, there's lots of little references.
Lovely.
It's very beautiful. Yeah.
Christmas Eve at 8 o'clock on Sky One. That's one I'll be glued to. Wonderful. Love the sound of that. I'm also very excited about, as an Agatha Christie and a Kenneth Branagh fan, There You Are in Death on the Nile. I'm very excited about that. This is great stuff now. You're really bringing us all the joy of this Christmas, Dawn. Tell me.
Well, you know, that is a giant film, but we made it a year ago. And of course, you know, who can release a great big Hollywood blockbuster like that at the moment with nobody going to the cinema? So, you know, they've held on to it and held on to it. But, and I've only seen glimpses of it, bits where I've done, you know, ADR sound work and stuff like that on it and a trailer. But oh my goodness, it's so slick. It's so sexy. It's completely sizzling. And what a fantastic guy Ken Branagh is to work for. I mean, not only has he got a major twinkle, but he is such a, and he's very cheeky, but he is such a consummate director, because of course he's an actor.
Yes.
So in this film, not only is he giving us his marvellous Poirot, with the great big moustache, slightly smaller this year than the one before.
Oh, right, okay.
That took over a little bit. but he's also the director, you know, he's the director, he's the lead actor, he's the producer, and he's the person that you want to please on the set. Oh, my goodness, I've never gone to a set, albeit a giant, great, big Nile cruiser built to scale, you know, like big Hollywood film set, amazing. You go to that set prepared. You know your lines. You've got your correct shoes on. You don't muck about. You could, but you don't, because you want to raise your game for Ken. You want to give him the best possible performance you can. And it's a great story. And Jennifer and I recreate the characters that were played in, you know, in the one that was made, was it in the 70s?
Yes.
With Bette Midler and Maggie Smith playing these
Bette
parts.
Bette Davis and the whole lot. Yeah, it'll be
mad.
Bette
Davis, that's right, not Bette Midler. Yeah. Why am I saying that? Yeah,
No, but do you and Jennifer have, not an obsession with, but an overweening fascination with whatever happened to Baby Jane? Like, I mean...
I know why you're saying that.
Well, I mean, there's a few reasons. There are a few reasons, Dawn. What is it about that film? I mean, it is bonkers,
well, because,
obviously.
You know, in our terminology, it's gagging for it. That's why.
What does that mean? No, explain that, please.
Well, it just screams, please take the miss out of me, you know, doesn't it? yes, and we've done that a few times, very definitely. But we recently have done a play, and we didn't give it that title. But David Quantick has written a very funny play that Jennifer and I have done that's going to be on the radio at Christmas.
And it's called?
It's called Whatever Happened to Baby Jane Austen.
Very clever. Yeah. I like that. I like that, of course. And you're also going to be featuring on The Vicar of Dibley, back on the screens here. That runs in Ireland. Massive. I'll read some text to you in a second now, but that's got a huge fan base here as well. So maybe
explain to
your fans what's happening there, Dawn.
Well, you know, we knew that the BBC were going to repeat some of the Vicars sort of leading up to Christmas. And I understand why they do. I've had lots of feedback from people during this terrible time that it's very comforting TV. And I'm delighted to hear that. So the BBC were going to repeat some. And we thought, well, you know, rather than just having the repeats, let's also film some new stuff. So what would Geraldine be doing during the lockdown? She would be ministering to her parishioners via webcam. That's what she'd be doing.
As is happening in churches around Ireland. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, we've managed to make 9 little tiny films of her zooming her parishioners all the way from the beginning of the lockdown in March all the way up to Christmas. So you see all the different changes in the restrictions. And, you know, when we go out, when we're eventually allowed to go out, we take Geraldine out with on her phone camera walking through Dibley. And we were back in Turville where we shot it originally. Right. And I was back with James Bleet, who plays Hugo Horton. And, you know, as we always do with Dibley, Dibley can be quite political. Dibley can be very fuzzy and comforting and lovely, but it can also be very real. So there's part of this where we pay a tribute to Alice, who is gone, of course. And it's a difficult thing, isn't it, when you're in a well-loved sitcom like that, where there's a character that is also very well-loved, and we know that the actress has gone. So we need to kind of mesh the two together, and I do a little eulogy to her, which was not easy to film, hasten to add. And of course, as Geraldine is talking about Alice, so too is Dawn talking about Emma. So, you know, and the audience know that, and that imbues it all with all of our love.
Oh, we're all on the cusp of tears the last few weeks as this bizarre year draws to an end. How have you been, Dawn?
I've been good, actually, because I am lucky enough to live in a beautiful place in Cornwall. I've got a lovely family, and it kind of drew us together. We all made a decision, right, let's hunker down together.
Good.
So I had both of my daughters with me. My son was just up the road. But, you know, we had times that we wouldn't ordinarily have. And I think a lot of people have experienced this, you know, where we had our moments that were tense, and I was quite anxious. But in the company of my daughters, having a big laugh and cooking far too much macaroni cheese and watching Drag Race on the telly and, you know, playing games to board games together and having celebrations of birthdays and stuff, having to make do inside the house was actually great. And we came through it as a very loving family. So I'm grateful in a funny way for that, because I think you've got to find the learning, haven't you, in all of these difficult moments. And we did do that. But I'm not. And I was also very lucky that at that time I was due to be work-wise. I was due to be writing the second draft of this book because of you. And so I was able to be doing my normal job at the normal time in a normal way in my house. So that was comforting for me. You know, meanwhile, of course, I was watching the future work that was a tour and other theatre work and stuff just disappear, just fall off a cliff. Like for so many people in this industry, it was that bit was very frightening. But we're going to get through it, Ryan. We're all going to get through it. And we'll be changed in a good way.
I hope so. And I think you're right. The cavalry is coming, as has been said. And even funny, because our lockdown's kind of lifting marginally in the next few days, and you can go to a restaurant or whatever. And I spoke to a number of people who said, I'm kind of nervous about going to meet friends and stuff, because it's been 9 months, and I kind of was enjoying the solitude, strangely, almost like Stockholm syndrome with the pandemic. Yeah. You know, it kind of almost enjoying the forced isolation. For some, obviously.
Yeah, well, hunkering down. Hunkering down is cozy, and getting out of your tight clothes and into your loose clothes is cozy. And it's quite hard to gear up again, but we all will, because we are longing for human contact. That's what we want. And we want our music back.
Yeah, and our theatre, as you say. And
want to be in the company of those that enrich us, you know. And we you know, look at it, we've, since the beginning of time, you know, man has obviously had to find food and water and shelter, but we've also told stories and danced and sung. And so for me, it's a human need just as strong as any other. So that's what I'm longing for is you know, I tell you something, when we did the Beatrix and Roald film, because we were all tested as actors to go on the set, and Rob Brydon plays my husband in that, and I had to hug him on the first day of filming, and it felt very strange because I hadn't hugged anyone for months except for people in my family, and I actually held on to him and I said, I'm really sorry, Rob, but I've got to do this for longer than is comfortable, because it just feels so blooming good.
Oh, isn't it amazing? Mary Rooney from Rathcoole in Dublin said, I love Dawn French, and I watched the Victor of Dibley all the time. It never ages. Thank you, Dawn, and rock on. Another love, Dawn French, says Denise, I still love watching her in The Vicar of Dibley, a brilliant show and a very talented lady. Another says, please ask the wonderful Dawn French if rumours of a return. Well, we've just covered that. Don't worry about that. And Kira says, I'm a huge fan of Dawn's. I'm dying to get her book. I follow her on Twitter, and her pictures of Cornwall are amazing. Yes. Love Dawn Frances Teresa. She's straight up gorgeous. Her heart shines in this sweet interview. Yes to kindness. Yes to listening to your kids. Looking forward to her book. So hardworking. And I had never heard about Roald Dahl and Beatrix Potter meeting. Oh, to be a fly on the wall. Which you wouldn't want to be, because either one of them would have swatted you and probably killed you. So
that's true. Then drawn you
and
dead.
I read the whole novel about it. Okay, listen, Dawn, it's been a real pleasure. We'll do it again in real life when the...
Absolutely. Love talking to you, Ryan.
Likewise.
Always.
Really nice to see you. To you and your family, happy Christmas. And congratulations on the book.
Okay.
All the best. Thanks, Dawn.
Thank you so much.
Dawn French joining us live from London, as it happens. And Because of You is the novel that, like I said, will resonate with a lot of people listening in this morning, that story. And it gets into serious drama, by the way, and quite a thriller. And we couldn't talk too much about it because the latter half and into the end is too easy to give away. So, that's a dramatic book. And again, from the pen of Dawn French, called Because of You. What a lovely person. A smart lady is a text from Maureen from O'Health says, you're right, Ryan. We all have that syndrome and we're getting fond of this aloneness. Well, I think some people are only coil springs waiting to get out. But some are just going, I've had enough. Jackie says in Kildare, I look forward to seeing the brilliant Dolly Parton on The Late Late Show. And some years ago, I went to see her perform at Nolan Park on a cold, breezy day in Kilkenny. And it was after a stormy night when the gantry was left damaged, black material blowing around in tatters. They wanted to cancel. She wouldn't hear of it. It was cold. She was cold. Eventually, halfway through, after much persuasion, she donned a coat over her outfit. She apologised for her cold fingers while playing her guitar, but carried on. What a trooper. She chatted away between songs about her life and said she was often far colder when she was growing up. She was a tough girl. And I wonder, does she or anyone else remember that decidedly chilly night in Kilkenny? But it's a good memory. And I look forward to talking to her, as I say, on Friday week. Let's take a break.